Yeah, but what I was saying is that I've been drinking about the same amount of coffee this week that I normally do, which is no more than a cup a day. I usually get almond milk latte, which is, I think, 2 shots of espresso. Been drinking the same amount this week, but it's been hitting me like rocket fuel. I don't know what's happened, if Baba Java changed their recipe or what, but Baba Java's that coffee shop. It's in Hoover. It's right on the way to the office, so I stop there every morning. Their coffee is actually noticeably better to me. I don't have a developed palate at all. Like, I can drink 5 different types of wine, and it all tastes basically the same to me. I can't distinguish notes like that. Mm-hmm. But this coffee is noticeably tastes better to me than any other coffee that I ever drink. They're so picky about where they source it from, what altitude it's grown at. And I don't know of any other coffee shops, especially in Birmingham, that put that kind of care into what they make, and you can taste it.
Well, what country is it from? Costa Rican? Is it Colombian?
All over the place. But what they specialize in is Turkish coffee. Turkish coffee. It's, I believe it's brewed in a different way. I'm going to absolutely butcher the process if I try to explain it. But they have several different blends, and some of them are grown in different areas. They have a podcast, actually, of their own called Coffee U. And it's where they educate you about how they brew their coffee. I listened to an episode recently, and they were talking about that for coffee to be classified as something, it has to be grown at exactly, I don't know, 5,000 feet or whatever. There are really strict specifications to coffee production, it turns out. And I can't explain it, but it'd be an interesting conversation to hear on Coffee U.
You know, I learned just a few years ago that the actual bean, the dark roast coffee is actually not as strong as medium, and the light roast is the strongest. I thought it was completely the opposite way around. That's why I was, you know, my question was, when you felt like you were getting a better kick the last couple of weeks, have they changed it to, you know, a lighter roast? Maybe that's where that kick is coming from.
Maybe, but yeah. Whatever it is, it's got me talking fast. It's got me walking faster. It's got, I'll be in here talking to a patient and they're like, slow down. You're talking way too fast. You're talking faster than your mouth can move.
That's the effect you're after. So you got
sure,
it, now, right?
Yeah, it works for me.
All right, brother. So what are we going to talk about today?
Gut microbiome. We could talk for 5 hours about it, but we need to just touch on the highlights or else we'll be here all day. So I think gut microbiome is a huge topic that we can at least pull some highlights from. So you want to start us off?
Okay. Well, let's see. Yeah, a lot of the top selling books right now correlates one way or another with the gut, especially the correlation between that and all these inflammatory conditions we're dealing with, including most brain inflammation-related issues. Everything from Alzheimer's, autism, Parkinson's, they all have a correlation and a connection to the gut. Science is now coming around to that. The gut's been called the second brain. The correlation's there. And there's certain bacteria that belong only in the gut, and we're finding them in the brain now because they actually have the availability to cross that blood-brain barrier. But how'd they get there? Leaky gut, right? And truth to it is probably the greatest precursor to leaky gut in our society is going to be glutens and antibiotics.
And alcohol. Those would be the big three. And before we go so deep into this, let's start with the absolute basics. Let's talk about exactly what we're referring to when we say terms like gut microbiome. And what we're talking about there is the bacteria that's housed within your digestive system. It's what breaks down the foods that you eat, and it's living. What is interesting about the gut microbiome is that the human body contains more bacterial cells than it does human cells. We're made up of more bacteria than we are human, actually. That's why in the ratio of healthy bacteria to unhealthy bacteria, like H. pylori and pathological bacteria, that's why it's so important to keep that in a good balance, is because it has effects that reach much further than a stomach ache.
Right. Gut bacteria belongs in the gut, not in the rest of the body. So maintaining a healthy immune system is to keep the bacteria in check. So when we talk about these bacteria that wind up leaking out of the gut, winding up in the blood system, and then crossing over the blood-brain barrier, very pro-inflammatory. The average child in America, for example, by the time they're 1 year of age, they've had two rounds with antibiotics. And then, of course, in a perfect world, we would offset the damage done by the antibiotic, which had a job to do initially. But we have to follow up and put friendly flora back in that gut. And this is something that a lot of people are aware of, but we don't take it serious enough to do it. And I'll have patients who will have a child on an antibiotic, and afterwards they might even ask the pediatrician if a probiotic would be a good idea. Their response often is, yes, that's a good idea. Not that they recommended it initially without being asked the question.
It's kind of like a sure, why not kind
sure.
of thing.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Think of the actual word, antibiotic. Bio mean life, mm-hmm. anti, against. Think about the word, what it means, and then think about pro. Pro is the opposite of anti, so probiotic, so it's pro-life. So, of course, you want to take a probiotic while you're taking an antibiotic and then after, because in order to undo the damage to your gut microbiome that is carried out by an antibiotic, it takes quite some time to rebuild that healthy bacteria, depending on which antibiotic you took and what it was for and how long you were taking it. When I see functional medicine patients, a lot of times I'll see patients who have been on intravenous antibiotics for a long period of time for whatever it may be, autoimmune condition or whatever they were trying to throw the book at. In order to bounce back from years on intravenous antibiotics, that's a years long process. You're not just going to take some acidophilus, one bottle, and feel back to normal. You know, that's a huge gut rebuilding process. And we have gut rebuilding programs you can go through that can help reverse leaky gut. But it's a very long process, and it's not something that most people know how to do on their own.
It's a process that if you don't do a rebuilding, the damage that can be done from even short-term antibiotics can be a lifetime of damage, especially if we throw more complications on top of it, such as wheat, grain, and do more destruction to the gut following the antibiotic. A lot of the treatment for the autoimmune disorders are, you know, very gut-wrenching steroids as well. A lot of times, by the time you actually get to the source of that, it can take years to rebuild that. I think I was telling you the other day, too, that link between obesity and antibiotic use. We were talking about how in the Southeast here, the population, the heaviest populations in the Southeast, and that just happens to be the highest population of antibiotic use.
Even if patients have only taken one round of antibiotics, it's important to go through a gut rebuilding protocol. Some of those programs may be a little more intense than others, but when you kill off not only the bad bacteria, but also the good bacteria, right. because the antibiotics are not selective in what they kill, that gives pathological bacteria the opportunity to thrive, such as Candida. That's an easy one that most people have heard of. Candida is a bad bacteria overgrown in your body. It becomes a bad bacteria. So it feeds off of sugar. It feeds off of yeast. A high sugar diet, if there's a lot of alcohol being taken in, that's going to help Candida to thrive in your body. And that can lead, chronic Candida can lead to all types of other issues. Everything from headaches to skin rashes to tinea versicolor. You know about that one?
Mm-hmm.
Tinea versicolor, you've seen it. It looks like sunspots. And it often grows on elbow creases and back. It's a skin condition, but the root cause is Candida. And you can Google it all day long. I know because I used to have this. You can Google it all day long. And the recommendation will be, okay, use Celsom Blue shampoo as your body wash. I did that for months, and it did absolutely nothing. So it's not treating the root cause. It's intended to treat a skin issue, but tinea versicolor is not really a skin issue. it's a gut issue. So you got to go to the root cause. And that didn't go away for me until I went through a gut rebuilding program. It turned out that my microbiome was thrown off from not only using antibiotics a couple of times, but also from drinking too much in college and from eating crap foods before I started to pay more attention to my health.
You know, talking about the candida, we all have a little bit in our biome. It's when it overruns the system. And then with candida, when it overruns, it craves sugar. So therefore, you crave sugar when your candida is in control. And there again, now we have a weight gain issue associated with a bacteria. There's also a particular bacteria that's in the stomach that loves sugar as well, that basically it thrives on that and actually creates more fat storage within the cell. I think it's called Firmicutes, and high numbers of these are found in overweight people. So it correlates with obesity. They tend to have more of this particular type of bacteria within their gut. What came first, the weight gain issue, or did the actual bacteria come along creating the weight gain problem? They really thrive on carbohydrates.
And you mentioning that specific bacteria reminds me of that they took a sample of bacteria that was known to be linked to obesity, and they injected it into a mouse with a normal body composition. Within a very short amount of time, just from having this bacteria implanted into its gut, the mouse started to get fat. They had a mouse who was overweight. They found a way to remove this one specific strain of gut bacteria. And within a very short amount of time, that mouse started to lose weight back down to normal. So science is finally catching up to what a lot of holistic practitioners have already known, that the balance of good bacteria to bad bacteria and what those specific bacterias are has a major impact on your overall health, not just your weight, not just your body composition, but everything from your mood to depression to anxiety to other mental issues to possibly things like autism, like you mentioned earlier. Can you talk about that?
Big time with the autism. The studies found that actually we all harbor the gene for autism. We talked about this in other podcasts that, you know, you may have that particular protein, if you will, but if it's not expressed, then it lays dormant and we don't develop that particular condition. Some other anti-inflammatory medicinal stuff, such as olive oil, is real good research on that. But I think it's pretty interesting to look what other possible inflammatory conditions, including, how about obesity? And you were just talking about that pro-inflammatory bacteria that's in the body, and you have that one person who's done everything they can possibly think of to try to get off those last 10 pounds. Maybe it's bacterial within the stomach. So clean the gut up. Again, everything sort of comes back to that, right? Comes back to the gut. And you and I know the same thing. If we have a particular person that may have a half a dozen ailments, we know we have to start at the gut.
So far, we've mentioned a couple of terms I want to make sure people understand the difference between, and that's probiotic versus prebiotic. So a probiotic is an actual strain. It could be one, it could be more, depending on the blend. It's actual strains of bacteria that you take, is in mostly in capsule form, and it goes into the gut. And the idea is that it implants into the lining and it can start a colony. Prebiotic, on the other hand, is oftentimes a fiber. It's a form of food that the bacteria in your gut eat and thrive on, and they can start to improve their numbers by eating the right types of fiber. And on the last podcast, I mentioned that Instagram account, Jason Whitrock. He's the guy that wears the continuous glucose meter on his arm, and he eats a food, and then he checks his blood sugar 2 hours later and tells you what it is. The most interesting one that I've seen that he did this with white potatoes and he did this with white rice. Two very starchy foods that typically run your blood sugar up pretty high when you eat it normally. First, he checked white rice that he had just cooked and it was still hot, and it spiked his blood sugar to maybe 130, 140. Then he cooled that rice down in the refrigerator. He got it cold. And then he heated it up again and he ate it. And it didn't spike his blood sugar at all. It stayed below 100. So the cooling process turns a starch into a resistant starch, which is a form of prebiotic fiber that can feed the healthy gut bacteria. And that's why it doesn't run your blood sugar up as high, is because your gut bacteria is having a field day thinking, okay, I've got a feast now, so we can eat it all. That way it doesn't translate into sugar in your blood. Same thing with white potatoes. He checked the effect that white potatoes had on his blood sugar when they're just heated up straight out of the oven. And it obviously spiked his blood sugar way up, just like the white rice. And then he tried the same method. He cooled down that white potato in the refrigerator, maybe overnight. And then he heated it up again and he ate it, and it didn't spike his blood sugar at all. So what we see here is that cooling down a starch can turn it into a resistant starch, which is a prebiotic fiber, which is great for your gut microbiomes.
Yeah, I sort of stay away from the white potato primarily because of the glycemic index you were talking about, the sugar load to the body. But I find that very interesting that once you cool that down, and you said even once you reheat it, you still have a friendlier bacteria in that resistant starch.
Right, it completely changes the glycemic index there.
And going into the prebiotic, because this has really become popular probably over the last 10 years. I think we've known about probiotics, why, for 30, 40 years, maybe plus, but the prebiotic is sort of kind of new on the horizon here. You were talking about your flora within your gut. I have a different flora than you do. You know, your mom and you have similar flora. Your dad and you have similar flora. Your mom and dad have different flora.
Joey, don't talk about my mother's flora. Mary Horton has pure flora.
I understand. I'm not touching your flora on that. But it's different than my flora, which I like to think is a clean flora
as well.
I would
hope so, yeah.
And so this is another reason why a lot of times, this very interesting thing from this other physician that I was listening to a podcast of his, was talking about how a lot of these gene-related pathologies that we develop, there's a very strong correlation more towards the gut, because a lot of us have the same similar bacteria within the gut. So a lot of the healthcare conditions that might pass around from one generation to the other generation can be directly correlated with the gut genome. So another great place to look at. And you were talking about the rice and the white potato. Some really good prebiotics are sweet potato. Kale is another good prebiotic. Some mushrooms as well. Check this out. Artichokes, leeks. Now, I'm not a big fan of leeks, but I do like some sweet potato. And then, of course, one of the more popular ones that Standard Process uses is chicory root. And another product, by the way, that Standard Process puts out is a really good probiotic with a prebiotic in it called Prosymbiotic. Now, this is great because they got those top four strains of probiotic. And there's a kicker, little extra addition, is the prebiotic inulin in with it. So this is like a go-to product for almost all my patients. You were mentioning something else, too, about...
Wait, Joey, so you can either eat leeks and kale, or you can just take a pill for it?
In this instance, yeah, you could.
Seems like a no-brainer to me. Leeks, well, come on, give me a break.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Now, you know, I'll take my kale. I do love my kale.
I mean, it's okay. You know, I tolerate it, but if you think about it objectively, is kale tasty? No, eat it because you know it's healthy.
Yeah, but a sweet potato, now to me, a sweet potato is dessert. Especially half a stick of butter in there and a little cinnamon. Oof. There you go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's my pumpkin pie at Thanksgiving.
So you take the Standard Process prebiotic plus probiotic, that's your go-to?
Yes, and that's in one. It's called Prosymbiotic. So they, you know, these guys are rocket science smart, and so they, you know, they take this and put it in one. Some antibiotics, when you take them, you really can't take a probiotic with them because it kills that off as well, certain strains. So some of these stronger strains, like some Prosymbiotic, you can take this with your antibiotic. Now, I recommend to my patients you don't take them at the same time. A couple hours in between your antibiotic and your probiotic. Also, for me, when I try to take an antibiotic, I get dysbiosis, irritable stomach very, very quickly. The probiotic helps to offset that, so I don't get as uncomfortable.
I know a lot of people are thinking, you know, I'm not taking antibiotics right now, but can I still take this anyway?
Smart move, yes. You know, because we don't always eat as well as we would like to. And at the same time, why not maybe do something very pro for our immune system? Why not go ahead and build the army up before we actually wind up needing it? If you don't throw the probiotic back in there, something else is coming along. It can be a very mild bacteria that can come in, set up host very, very quickly. And 2 weeks later, they're having another flare-up if, you know, of perhaps the same problem that they were having before. Say it's a UTI, for example. It's just a continual cycle, you know, about the half-life of the antibiotic. It cuts it back for a little bit, and then after that 2 weeks or so is over, here it comes back again. It's just a miserable.
Katie told me that she used to get frequent UTIs when she was in high school and maybe in college as well. And, of course, she was prescribed lots of antibiotics for it. Nothing helped ever. Nothing ever changed. She would get them maybe monthly. It was just happening all the time until she discovered D-mannitose, the supplement. D-mannitose, you can buy it pretty much anywhere. D-mannitose is what completely stopped her from getting UTIs. Once she started taking that as a daily supplement, she never got one again.
Different things out there work. You know, a lot of people use cranberry, which to a degree can help, but it's not the best, in my opinion, that's out there.
People, when they get a UTI, will oftentimes go to the grocery store and get cranberry juice, what they think is cranberry
with
juice,
sugar in it.
But it's actually cranberry cocktail, which is high sugar. But what you have to get is, they have it at Whole Foods. It's cranberry. It's true 100% cold-pressed cranberry juice, and it is not sweet. It is as bitter as you can imagine, and you drink that. Now, that's what they recommend when you're having a UTI, not cranberry cocktail like you're going to buy Ocean Spray at Publix. That's not going to do anything for you but make it worse.
I've tried that cranberry, and that's stout, tart to say the least. You can't even dilute it down to where I can actually enjoy it. So, I'd recommend the probiotic and the prebiotic. And the other thing, too, about UTIs, you have to go all the way to the kidney to really get rid of them. And that I find to be the problem with most, is they don't finish the job. And a lot of times the antibiotic is not going to clean out the kidney. And so, therefore, it just lays dormant, only to remorph within a couple of weeks back again. So the process that I use, we're going to clean out all the way up to the kidney.
The gut's not the only place that you have a microbiome. You have one in your mouth, and women have one in their vagina. It's something that you have in any type of mucous membrane.
Basically any orifice, really, if you think about it, right? Really interesting treatment protocols, antimicrobial, antibacterial, you know, garlic. You know, again, we're talking about the polyphenols like coffee, tea. These are good for nourishing the gut bacteria as well.
Olive oil. Interesting that you mentioned garlic, because, you know, in all the old stories, they say that garlic kills the vampires. Think about what it does into your gut. It kills off the bad bacteria, which in a way are vampires to your body. You know, they're pulling the nutrients out of the food
that
you're eating.
So
I think that's kind of where the story of garlic killing vampires came from. But olive oil is full of polyphenols. Actually, the good olive oil is. Let me back up. Good olive oil is full of polyphenols, but most of what you're going to buy on the shelf at Publix or Piggly Wiggly is not going to be pure, high-quality olive oil. In fact, a study done a few years ago that tested a lot of the most popular brands, like Pompeii olive oil, they tested it and they found out that a lot of it was half and half canola oil with the olive oil. So I did a deep dive into olive oil, found out what some of the best quality brands are. So what I did is I joined the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. You join, you pay them, and they mail you three of the freshest bottles of olive oil that straight from the most recent harvest.
Pressing.
Yeah, and they tell you where it came from. They tell you what orchard and all the olives were pulled from, and these are not blends of different olives. These are all from the same crop. And it tells you the amount of polyphenols that's in that particular bottle. The average amount of polyphenols that you're going to find in a bottle of olive oil at Publix is under 100. The fresh, real olive oil that you're getting from a really good quality olive oil that you might find online is well over 400. And what that does for your body is you can feel, you think a little more clearly, you have more energy, your joints feel better. Olive oil has a lot of omega-3 fatty acids, And that's huge for your joints. It lubricates your joints. It's like drinking motor oil for a car. You know, it just makes everything feel better.
Very pro anti-inflammatory, which was also the study I was telling you about earlier about the autism and why they mentioned the same thing. They mentioned specifically a form of California olive oil. And this article came out maybe 5 years ago, and they were talking about the same thing, how some of even the Italian oil that was coming in was not 100% pure. And that's why they were recommending a particular kind out of California. Here's a little pearl that most people aren't aware of. If you keep your olive oil in the kitchen on the counter, within about 2 weeks, you got a rancid oil. So either one, you keep it in the refrigerator. The difficult thing about that is it kind of gels. So take a couple of pearls of vitamin E. And if you have a rather large bottle of olive oil, which is what we carry in the kitchen, I like about 2 to 3 pearls. You just poke a hole in the pearl of the vitamin E and you squeeze that into the bottle of the olive oil. And that antioxidant actually protects that from going rancid for months at a time.
That's right. And you also want to keep it in a dark place because sunlight also will make it go rancid. So you want to keep it dark. And that's why a good olive oil will oftentimes come in a really dark green glass container.
Yep.
If the olive oil you're buying is in a plastic container, it's likely blended heavily with canola.
Or even a clear glass container. Yeah, that's kind of your sign there, too, that people don't really know what they're packaging.
Yeah, Joey, we got a listener question here. So let's move on from microbiome to addressing Leah's question here. Actually, she has two questions. She says, menopause and depression, how does it affect the body, like weight gain, muscle problems, etc.? You want to dive into the effect that menopause has on the body overall?
Nobody really likes getting older, I guess, so maybe that's a mild case for depression there in and of itself. But that part of that cycle, what's happening there is estrogen is starting to, production starting to slow down. Now it's the stress hormone's job to kick in and supply the female hormones moving forward. And of course, that's the stress glands. So here. Being adrenal glands and cortisol. And a point to be taken, for example, hot flashes, ladies, is really not normal. So many women in our society, hot flashes are just part of it. And in reality, that's not supposed to happen if our adrenal stress glands are functioning strong, which in our society, again, we're talking stress glands, my God, whose are? It's becoming commonplace. The abnormal in today's world has become the normal, which is kind of a scary situation. If the adrenal glands are functioning, highly functioning, they will take over balancing out the thermostat in the body to settle those hot flashes from occurring. But in our society, they're burned out. They're not working properly. So it's much more common for people to start experiencing those, probably even premenopause, as early as their 30s, some of them.
Do you have any specific recommendations for hot flashes?
Iodine and hot flashes. Those combinations right there will almost wipe it out immediately. But then again, iodine is necessary for every function of every gland within the body. So, and we're so deficient in that. So let me say it doesn't surprise me at all how well that works. Also, the question that was asked as far as that depression aspect of it, well, that's what the stress glands are, man. When we're stressed, we're depressed, right? That's just those things go together. And I tell people, you know, you show me somebody who's depressed and I'll show you somebody who's anxious, and you show me somebody who's anxious and I'll show you somebody who's depressed. And you find that a lot in, you know, that 35 to 55-year-old age group, and especially with women, they just want their life back. And this is when things start to unravel and then stress the family responsibility. And it can just overwhelm sometimes. Again, I get back to these adrenal glands. Here's the problem with that is that, and you know, in our society today, they don't even have a diagnosis for what we call adrenal fatigue. Okay, the insurance companies don't even have a code by which the doctors can even bill for it. So therefore, they're not even teaching it anymore in medical schools. Like, it doesn't exist. And my God, it's more prevalent now than it probably has ever been in history of mankind, right? So since they're not teaching it, nobody's actually treating it. And if they do treat it, you're exactly right, they're going to treat it with an antidepressant because, of course, I'm depressed. I'm fatigued. I don't feel well. I am not myself. I want my life back. And I'm stressed and burned out all the time. What is this? And since we're not diagnosing it, therefore we're not treating it, and we're throwing a Band-Aid on it because I'm frustrated, I'm depressed, so here's an antidepressant. Not fixing a thing, covering everything up, only making it, what, worse farther down the line.
Second question from Leah here. She says, bones in older people, how do we keep them healthy and strong? And I'll jump in on that one. The first one is a pretty obvious one to me, and that is going to be resistance training. Putting your bone under a weight-bearing load is going to send it a signal that it needs to become more dense to carry this heavier load that's being placed on it, to meet the demands that are being placed on it. So it's Wolf's Law.
That's it.
It's a bone that pressure is being applied to, whether that be weight-bearing or some sort of outside force, it releases a cell called osteoblasts. And the osteoblasts build bone. And by releasing more of these, you can increase your bone density. So the best way to improve your bone density over time is simply resistance training. And that could be with resistance bands. It could be with body weight. It could be, if you're strong enough, it could be with actual weights. But anything you do that adds a load to your body is going to help to improve your bone density.
The bone density, and let's not forget the bone strength.
Density does not necessarily equal strength.
Bingo, it does not at all. And so we're testing a density, which is really why it's about the strength of the bone, and there's really no way to test that bone strength. And if we're looking at a dense bone in these testing for the osteoporosis, if you will, if we're this dead bone, then who cares about the density of it? It's not going to withstand any force. And so we're actually probably making this condition much worse. They're called the phosphate drugs. We're in the wrong ballpark here. Strength is the key.
I was telling a patient about this the other day, is that one of the best predictors for all-cause mortality is leg strength. And that is because if your legs are strong enough to pop out in front of you and catch yourself before you fall, then you have a far less likelihood of dying early.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But life is motion. Got to keep moving. Getting back to the question.
She's asking about bones and older people, how to keep them healthy and strong.
Leah. Okay. Well, good point. Leah, here's a key thing that I think is missed big time by just about everybody that's on the calcium train, if you will. More important than actually consuming minerals, calcium, magnesium, is absorbing. So some of the more popular calcium products, Caltrate being an example, one most people know or are familiar with, we're looking at a form of calcium that's not absorbable really by the body, okay? We need ionized calcium in order for it to be absorbed. And this form of calcium is the most popular, cheapest brand, calcium carbonate. I tell my patients, you might as well lick the sidewalk. It's rock is what it is. It's limestone. So the body really can't utilize this. So here we are trying to take this thing to try to strengthen our bones. And on top of that, of course, we're throwing 1,500 milligrams in it over a day. So maybe if we're lucky, we'll absorb 100 milligrams of it. So the important thing is to make sure you're using an absorbable form of calcium. But here's the thing that people are missing. The key is you have to get that calcium in the tissue that needs it. And that is where the vitamin that we know as vitamin F, which is, again, polyunsaturated fatty acids, they put this calcium where it belongs. Otherwise, it's just running through the blood. Vitamin D is good. Hey, well, what does vitamin D do? Vitamin D gets it into the blood. It does not drive it into the tissue. That's what your vitamin F does. So just as important as taking calcium, you got to absorb it. Otherwise, it's just running through the system. Maybe it just runs through the system till it either builds up as kidney stones, cataracts, or plaquing on the arteries, right? We've got to absorb that calcium. So just as important as taking it, you've got to assimilate it. All right, dude. What else do you got? Question-wise, anything?
No, Leah just asked us those two. So I have another one saved up for our next episode. So let's visit that one then. And if anybody else has any listener questions they'd like to submit, you can reach out to us through email, drchasewharton@gmail.com. You can shoot your listener questions to me, and I'll make sure that Dr. J and I address them on an upcoming episode. As always, this episode is brought to you by Rocky Ridge Chiropractic. Give us a call at 205-823-8284 if you need again for any chiropractic or nutrition help.
Have a great week.
Thanks for tuning in.